Well, welcome to our last day of oral argument for this term. We have three very interesting cases today. I have to ask my marshal a question. I didn't get your signal. Is the group still not here? They are here. All right, very good. Thank you. The reason I asked the question is that I had a little note that the Lakeshore Technical College students were going to come and join us this morning, and I wasn't sure if they were here or not, and our marshal tells me they are. So would they please stand with their faculty advisor? Very good, very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Please be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class that the Supreme Court operates in combination with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So the students have gotten a little information about this case, and they'll hear oral argument. And then if they can stick around after the next oral argument at the break over the noon hour, Justice Shirley Abrahamson will come and talk with you a little bit about aspects of the Supreme Court, and she's been doing it for quite a while, so if you come back, I'm sure that you'll have a good discussion. Now, we've met you a little bit. I'd like to introduce you all to the members of the court as well. On my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her is Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left is Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with those introductions made, I will call our first case for the day, State versus Finley, 14 AP 2488. Counsel, are you prepared to begin? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Ballasperi. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the state of Wisconsin on this appeal. We are the petitioner. Case involves one very specific issue, and that is the issue of what is the appropriate remedy when a criminal defendant has been misadvised of the correct maximum penalty at the time he pleads guilty. When the defendant is misadvised that the maximum penalty is less than the maximum penalty actually permitted by law, and then at the sentencing, the defendant actually gets the correct maximum, which is more than he was told he could get when he pleaded guilty, more than he thought he could get.
Mr. Ballasteri, was there a, my recollection is there was a circuit court finding that the defendant entered his plea in a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary fashion.
Well, I think there was one at one time. You got to remember, this is actually the second appeal in this case.
And in the first one, he asked for the relief of the proper sentence, to have the extra legal part of it.
Actually, that yes, that was one alternative remedy that he requested.
Didn't the circuit court find that the plea had been made in a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary fashion? And if so, what are we to make of that?
That finding, originally there was an initial denial of the defendant's motion.
Right.
That went up on appeal. The Court of Appeals in that first appeal ruled that there had been a Bangert violation. In other words, that the defendant was not correctly advised of the proper maximum penalty. So the Court of Appeals in that first appeal sent the case back down to the circuit court for a determination of whether the defendant actually knew the correct maximum penalty. It was the state's burden at that point under Bangert to prove that the defendant knew the correct maximum penalty. We didn't do that. We failed to do that.
Now, that's not what the trial court said. Why are you saying you failed to do that? You're losing me a little bit.
Okay, this is on the second. This is on the second hearing after the remand from the Court of Appeals on the first appeal.
Didn't the trial court, after the Court of Appeals first found a Bangert violation, send it back down for a hearing to determine if the plea had been knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
Yes.
Okay, and did the trial court make a finding that, in fact, the state had met its burden of proving that there had been a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary entry of the plea?
No, not at that point. Not
I
on
thought
the
that
second. Not on the
trial
remand.
Court didn't say that when it went back down to do the Bangert hearing. It didn't make any findings on that.
What it made a very brief, the circuit court made a very brief order. It said, it was two pages of the transcript. It said, the defendant is entitled to reduction of his sentence. I'm going to reduce his sentence to the 19 and a half years he was told he could get.
You're telling me that the circuit court made no statement that the state had met its burden of proving the plea was knowing and intelligent and voluntary.
Well,
that's what you're telling me.
At one point, I think the court did say that during the second hearing. But it went on in its statement in terms of its ultimate conclusion, made a statement that would have been inconsistent with any such actual finding. The court said he was entitled to reduction of his sentence, which implies that the defendant did not knowingly enter
well,
his
court plea. Could have reduced the sentence under a variety of grounds, Counselor. My concern is understanding what the record says or what the record doesn't say.
Right.
Thank you.
And as long as you're bringing that up, I made this absolutely clear in my petition for review. I made this absolutely clear in my brief. We are not on this petition for review. We are not contesting the finding contesting, at least, I don't know how you want to phrase it, but we are not contesting Finley's assertion that his plea was not entered with an understanding of the correct maximum penalty.
Counsel, that's really the question that's behind these questions, if I'm reading my colleagues
now,
correctly.
Let me just say,
why are you conceding that?
Would you let Mr. Siegler speak, please?
Let me just
Counselor,
say.
Counselor, just be quiet for just a minute, okay? A justice is trying to ask you a question.
I thought I answered it.
I'm just asking why you're conceding that. That's really what's behind their questions, I think. Why are you making that concession?
Because the evidence. And I want to make clear what we are conceding. That's my whole point. I am not conceding that this plea was not knowingly entered. I am absolutely not conceding that. That's my entire argument, that it was knowingly entered. What I am conceding is that the defendant did not know the correct maximum penalty when he pleaded guilty.
Well, how can you knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily plead if you don't know the penalty to which you plead?
You can do it if you know the penalty that you actually get. And that is the whole point of my argument. If you are told that you can get a certain penalty, if you know and understand that you can get that penalty when you plead guilty, and you in fact wind up getting that penalty that you know you could get when you plead guilty, your plea is in fact knowing in the constitutional sense. Now, there's an error, no question about that, and we're conceding this. There is an error. He was misadvised of the correct maximum penalty, but that error was harmless. It was harmless because he did not get maximum.
Is that what Bangert says, though? I mean,
no,
aren't
Bangert
judges supposed
say that.
To...
Bangert never considered this issue.
Aren't judges supposed to give the correct information?
Yes, of course they are.
And aren't defendants supposed to enter pleas knowing the correct information?
Yes, of course.
And you're just saying, well, yeah, that's aspirational. And when it doesn't happen, so long as they get the sentence that they were told, it's okay.
That's what I'm saying. That is exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, one more thing. What did the PSI in this case say regarding the maximum possible penalty?
I don't recall what it said.
Okay. And was there an alternate PSI by the defense?
That I don't recall either.
Okay. Thank you.
Paragraph 2 of the Court of Appeals opinion sets forth at least what the Court of Appeals deems to be the historical facts regarding the hearing on remand from the Court of Appeals. The hearing was to determine if the plea was knowing and intelligently and voluntarily made. In paragraph 2, they state as follows. On remand, the state called only one witness, Finley's defense attorney, at the time the plea was entered. Finley's attorney testified he had no specific recollection of telling Finley the correct maximum penalty and I highlight this, and admitted he likely read to Finley the incorrect maximum penalty identified on the plea questionnaire waiver of rights form. The Court of Appeals goes on to say in the following sentence, the circuit court nonetheless entered an order concluding the state had satisfied its burden that it was a knowing and intelligent and voluntary. Is that a correct statement of the historical facts upon remand of what happened? There was only one witness, and that witness testified that he had no specific recollection, and he admitted he likely read to Finley the incorrect maximum penalty identified on the plea questionnaire and waiver.
Yes, those facts are correct, yes.
And is it those facts that cause you to back away, or the state to back away from the argument they had made before the case went to the Court of Appeals for the first time, that it was a knowing and intelligent and voluntary plea?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Why did the state decide to bring the case to the, or ask to bring the case to this court? What are the implications here?
Well, the Court of Appeals ruled in a published opinion, which is now the law in this state, that the only remedy when a defendant is incorrectly advised of the maximum penalty is plea withdrawal. And the Court of Appeals ruled that the remedy that was given by the trial court in this case, which was reduction of the sentence, was not an appropriate remedy under these circumstances. And we think the Court of Appeals was wrong.
Well, that's not really what the Court of Appeals said, though. I mean, you have Taylor and Cross out there, and those were incorrect penalty cases.
That's what the Court of Appeals held in this case.
The Court of Appeals disregarded Taylor and Cross?
Well, I don't think they disregarded Taylor and Cross. I think they wrongly interpreted Taylor and Cross. But they very plainly held that the only remedy for misinformation about the correct maximum penalty was withdrawal of the plea, and that the trial court's remedy here of reducing the sentence was not an appropriate remedy. And as I said, this is in a published opinion. This is now the law in this state until you will return it. That reduction of the sentence is never an appropriate remedy. That's why we petitioned for review, because we think the Court of Appeals was wrong on that point of law when they said you can't remedy the defect that existed in this case by reducing the guy's sentence.
If the Court of Appeals had determined that this remedy in this case was one that could be handed down rather than could never be handed down, but that plea withdrawal was the better remedy and reversed on that grounds and said why they thought plea withdrawal was better, would you still brought the case to us?
I can't I can't say for sure that I would or would not, but it would have been much less likely, let's put it that way, okay. If it was just a question of which was the more appropriate remedy in this case, probably not.
Okay.
I mean, we would have probably just said, okay.
So it's the absolutist nature as you interpret.
Yes, it's a statement of law that caused us to petition for review.
Okay, thank you.
So what we, the law as Justice Ziegler was indicating in some of her questions, the law that everybody has kind of relied on in this case, including the defendant back in the trial court at one point, is the Taylor and Cross cases, which do sort of deal with the question of an appropriate remedy when the maximum plea is misstated. Now, this court has specifically held that when the circuit court misstates the penalty by telling the defendant that the maximum penalty is more than the maximum penalty actually is as provided by law, that reduction of the defendant's sentence to the correct maximum is an available and appropriate remedy. What we are suggesting in this case is that just as reduction of the sentence can be an appropriate remedy when the defendant is misinformed that the maximum is more than it really is, it can also be an appropriate remedy when the defendant is misinformed that the maximum penalty is less than it actually is. Now, I want to make a couple of things clear. This court, in some of its prior cases, has taken some positions on what constitutes a constitutional violation that would automatically entitle a defendant to withdraw his plea, and what does not constitute a constitutional violation that would automatically entitle the defendant to withdraw his plea. In both Taylor and Cross, this court said, and said something that's very important to this particular issue, and that is that misinforming the defendant of the correct maximum sentence is not necessarily a due process violation. It is not necessarily a constitutional violation. So that withdrawal of the plea where there has been misinformation about the maximum penalty is not an absolute constitutional requirement, is not an absolute right of the defendant. If you have a situation where there is a violation of Bangert, and there clearly was in this case, Court of Appeals found that there was. We did not contest that. We did not petition for review on the first decision of the Court of Appeals. So there clearly was a Bangert violation, but not a constitutional, not necessarily a due process violation, and not necessarily a constitutional violation that automatically entitles a defendant to withdraw his plea. And basically our argument is this, and it's a very common sense, forget about the legal ramifications, it's a very common sense practical argument. If a defendant is told, you can get a certain sentence, if you plead guilty, I can sentence you to this much time in jail. I can sentence you to 19 and a half years. The defendant says, okay, I know that. I understand you can sentence me to 19 and a half years. I'm entering my plea knowingly taking the risk that you, judge, can sentence me to 19 and a half years, and he gets the 19 and a half years he knows he can get. That plea is knowingly entered because the defendant gets a sentence he knows he can get. Now, admittedly, that's not the situation in this case. That would be the situation if the defendant had originally gotten the 19 and a half years he was told he could get. The problem in this case is that the defendant didn't get the 19 and a half years. He got the 23 and a half years that was the actual statutory maximum. That was an error by the trial court. What can we do to correct the error? Well, if a defendant's plea is sufficiently knowing in the constitutional sense, if he gets the very penalty he is told he can get in the first instance, then his plea is knowing in the constitutional sense if his sentence is reduced to the sentence he was told and knew he could get. Where's the problem? There is none. In a common sense, practical way, there is absolutely no problem. He was told he could get the sentence. He knew he could get the sentence. He got the sentence he knew he could get. Where is the problem? There is none.
Where is the problem speaks to me of a euphemism for harmless error.
Well, you can say it's a euphemism. I actually said it was harmless error in the brief. I actually said and cited cases saying that the fact that he was misinformed of the actual correct maximum in a case, and I'll use both examples, in a case where the defendant actually gets the sentence he's told he could get, it is either harmless error under the harmless error test, or if you want to use the manifest injustice formulation, it is not a manifest injustice. We have cases standing for both propositions. It is either harmless error or not a manifest injustice, and in either case, it's inconsequential. It doesn't affect his substantial rights.
Yes.
And so when if that's true, if it is harmless error in a situation where the defendant is originally sentenced to the term he is told he can get, if the defendant gets the remedy of having his sentence reduced from the erroneous sentence he is originally given to the sentence that he is told and knew he could get, it becomes harmless. The error in giving him a sentence that was more than he was told he could get, that error is corrected. It's remedied by reducing the sentence. It becomes the fact that he was not told that the maximum was more, the fact that he was originally sentenced to the maximum that he didn't know he could get, all of that is remedied by bringing his sentence down to the sentence that he knew he could get. And I want to make clear that I believe that that is not only a remedy, not only a remedy that can be imposed, but it is the proper remedy in this case and in most cases, because it's a remedy that serves everyone's interests. I cited a whole bunch of cases that say the proposition that a remedy should be proportional to the wrong, and it should give the defendant, it should remedy the problem for the defendant without unnecessarily infringing on other people's rights or interests. And that's what reducing the sentence does.
You know, Mr. Balistrieri, in Cross, we held where the defendant was told a higher, but not substantially higher, penalty than the true maximum. Then there was no due process.
That's correct.
Violation.
That's what you said in Cross.
Pardon me?
Yes, that is correct. That's what
happened. I know. I wrote it.
Yes.
And here we have the opposite. We have the opposite factual issue. And one of the things I'm trying to puzzle about, because I remember the oral arguments in Cross very well, and one of the factors that was brought up was if someone is being accused of a crime and they're considering whether or not to go forward to trial, one of the things they're going to take into account is, gee, if I don't enter into a plea agreement with the state, what am I exposing myself to at trial? And that can be and is a very real world issue that people are confronted with, people who are accused of criminal activity are confronted with every day. And I'm trying to puzzle through for myself how this case, where we have the opposite situation, where he's told the lower number, winds up initially being handed down the higher sentence, Is there a similar issue for the calculus of someone going through that process who's told a lower number? And I'm trying to, I wonder if there's an intermediary step between your saying, gee, he's told a lower number, remedy, reduce it to the lower number. That has a certain intuitive appeal, but I wonder if there's an intermediary step we're not overlooking.
I believe that if you impose, if you give the defendant the remedy that I suggest of reducing his sentence, that puts the defendant in exactly the same position he would have been in if the 19 and a half years had been the correct maximum. So that in terms of his calculus, if you reduce his sentence to the 19 and a half years, assuming there was a calculus here,
right.
And I don't really think there was, but...
And what?
I don't really think there was a calculus here. I think this defendant was expecting to get what was recommended by the district attorney, which was about half of the maximum sentence. But you know, that's just my speculation, which I admit is just my speculation.
That wasn't part of the plea bargain?
I'm sorry?
That wasn't part of the plea
bargain? It was, yeah, there was a sentence recommendation as part of the plea bargain. Right. Right. But I think if you reduce the sentence to the sentence that the defendant is told he could get, that puts him in exactly the same position.
And so therefore it seems that what you're arguing is the risk that the accused would have had to sort of hedge his bets,
yeah,
by a larger exposure just wouldn't be there.
No, it goes away. If you reduce his sentence to the sentence he is told he could get,
right,
the risk is that he could get that sentence. So his calculation takes into account that risk.
And right. So the calculation would be exactly what?
Exactly the same.
Fits the facts. So the extra time that was recited to him in cross.
As I said in my brief, that... The time that he was told, the maximum that he was told, becomes the de facto maximum for purposes of this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, if we accept your view, then it would apply across the board any time the defendant was told that the maximum was less than it actually was. Is that right?
That's not my argument.
Pardon me?
That's not my argument. I didn't say it applies across the board.
Pardon me?
I did not say it applies across the board. I said it is the preferred remedy in most cases. I leave open the possibility that there are cases where it is not the preferred remedy or even an available remedy. To give you the obvious example, we have mandatory maximum penalties in Wisconsin. In some cases for child sexual assault, the mandatory maximum is 25 years. Let's assume that the defendant is charged with sexually assaulting a child. The mandatory max is 25. He is told that the discretionary maximum is 20. Well, you can't remedy that defect by reducing the sentence to 20 years because it's a mandatory maximum of 25.
It's an illegal sentence that way.
It's an illegal sentence, and the only thing you can do is withdraw the plea. So I'm not taking the position that reduction of the sentence is always the appropriate remedy, just that it is the preferred remedy in most cases. I just want to make it available as a remedy. That's all I'm arguing here.
What do you want to make available?
Reduction of the sentence as an available remedy.
And it sounds to me as if that would be in most cases where the judge misspoke, told a lesser sentence was the max available, and then imposes the larger sentence.
I believe that in most cases that would be the appropriate.
Yeah, I understand. And so it doesn't, at least you can give me one example,
And that's the example that would fit under 970, I have to find the statute, which the Court of Appeals said 973.13, because that would be a totally illegal sentence on the mandatory minimum if you gave, you didn't apply it. And that's why the Court of Appeals said that provision doesn't apply in this case.
I agree. It does not apply in this case.
Okay. And the other thing is the Court of Appeals wrote at great length why Taylor doesn't apply here and that it looks only superficially that it applies here. But as I read the Court of Appeals, in Taylor, there was sufficient evidence that the defendant actually knew what the maximum was.
That's correct.
And that in this case, because of concessions and the way the thing panned out, in this case, the defendant does not know. And that's how the Court of Appeals distinguishes Taylor.
And I am not suggesting that Taylor is controlling on all fours in this case. I am relying on statements of the law that this court made in Taylor and asking the court to apply those statements of law to the different factual situations.
So what would the opinion look like if you were drafting it, Mr. Ballastieri?
I give you the same answer I always give. It would look like my brief.
All right.
Thank you very much.
My
red lights. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Melkel. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the defendant, Mr. Timothy Finley, Jr. This court
You're
has
going
the
to have to get closer to that microphone and belt it in.
All right. Let me know if I'm still
spent
too soft,
a lot
okay?
of money, but we have not been able to repair this system.
Okay. This court
Thank
has...
You.
You're welcome. This court has the opportunity today to reaffirm Bangert and Brown and to continue to protect the plea-taking process. Bangert requires that it be affirmatively shown on the record that the defendant knows the rights he's giving up with and the potential punishments he is facing upon conviction. The U.S. Supreme Court has said for a guilty plea to be valid under the Due Process Clause, it must be an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right or privilege. It's the defendant's position that this waiver of rights, this relinquishment, is neither intentional nor knowing if the defendant is misinformed that the potential range of punishment is actually lower than that allowed by law.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you right away because I have a question that I want you to address during
Sure.
your argument. So when I'm looking at the transcript during the post-conviction motion hearing, and when I look at the transcript of the actual plea colloquy, it appears that the defendant was given contradictory information, but he was in fact advised of the maximum penalty because the court went through each of the charges with him, and specifically the maximum penalty for this offense will be imprisonment for not more than 12 years and 6 months. And then he went on, because you are a repeater, then they could increase the incarceration period by not more than an additional 6 years. They're also charging that you used a dangerous weapon. Then the term of imprisonment can be increased by not more than 5 years. Then the 19.5 incorrect math was on the plea questionnaire, and the court also mentioned that. But in fact, the court did advise him of the maximum possible penalties through that colloquy and later made a finding based in part on the testimony of the defendant's attorney that he had advised him the night before the plea of the maximum exposure. So the court made a finding that, in fact, the plea was made knowingly and intelligently. So how does that impact your argument that he's now claiming he didn't understand?
The circuit court at the second post-conviction hearing did make a finding that the defendant was aware of the potential punishment he was facing. He knew it was 23 and a half, and then the court still reduced the sentence after the fact. What the circuit court did is it did correctly state the separate penalties for the underlying F felony, dangerous weapon enhancer, and repeater provision. However, when at the end, he said the incorrect number of 19 and a half years. So for Mr. Finley to have known what the correct maximum was, he would have to have added it up while the trial court was saying it and then disregard what the trial court said at the end of it. So I think that finding is clearly erroneous, that Mr. Finley, in fact, knew the maximum penalty. And I also think there's case law by this court that there has to be an affirmative showing of the defendant's state of mind at the time he enters his plea, that he knew the correct information. And I think the state could have called the defendant to the stand and inquired what his knowledge was. They just relied on the testimony of the trial attorney, and I don't think the trial attorney's testimony, especially with the cross-examination indication that he probably went through the plea questionnaire line by line with the defendant and informed him that it was actually 19 and a half years. But I don't think this court took this case to determine whether or not Mr. Finley knew the correct maximum punishment.
Maybe we did, maybe we didn't.
Okay.
It seems to be of interest, at least to me.
Okay. And I think the record, I would just say I think it's clearly erroneous, that finding.
I understand that. But isn't there a fairly substantial body of case law that says that when one of our trial courts makes a factual determination following a hearing, that a reviewing court is to look for reasons to uphold the determination of the circuit court in discretionary orders? And isn't this such an order from the trial court? And as the information contained within Justice Rebecca Bradley's question included, it included the finding as well as the rationale for the trial courts. And I think there was further testimony, which is fairly common in these cases, that the defense attorney testified it's his usual practice to recite the correct here. But are we overlooking a necessary consideration as far as searching the record for reasons to uphold the trial court's finding?
I don't think so. I think the body of case law also says that there has to be affirmative evidence of the defendant's then existing mental state, and we don't have that on this record.
Affirmative evidence of the defendant's mental state?
Then existing mental state at the time he entered into his plea. So there has to be affirmative evidence that the defendant, in fact, knew the correct maximum penalty, and right now we just sort of have the absence of evidence. We just have I think the conclusion from the defense counsel is that he probably informed Mr. Finley of the...
I'm not saying that's the star of the evidentiary show.
Yeah.
I think you hit on it in your response to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question when you pointed out that in order for the defendant here to have known the actual number of the actual maximum, he would have had to have been adding up in his head. And
right,
you know,
and then
I understand that that's not how most people would be feeling at that moment as a judge is going over the number of years of prison that they face. And so that brings us to Mr. Balestrieri's argument that why isn't it an appropriate remedy to give him the benefit of his bargain? That if he was informed, 19 and a half years is the maximum, and there's parallel law that allows the Department of Corrections in instances where a sentence is imposed in top of the maximum legal sentence that the Department of Corrections, an administrative agency, is allowed simply to cut it off and say, sorry, Circuit Court Judge, you were wrong, and just reduce it. Why wouldn't it be a fair remedy consistent with the existing state of the law to say that your client was told a maximum potential penalty, and then if a mistake is made, and I don't think that we can set the standard of absolute perfection for anybody. I mean, it's a very human enterprise. And to say, okay, you bargained for, you went in knowing you faced a potential of 19 and a half years. We're going to now give you the benefit of your bargain.
I think the state's remedy is contrary to Bangert, the test that this court has adopted to protect the plea-taking process. What Bangert does is it makes it mandatory on the trial judge at the time the defendant is entering his plea to go over the 10 different...
Well, I think he's conceding that, but he's saying it's harmless.
This court has also repeatedly said there is no harmless error analysis in Bangert. Most recently in Taylor, the court made clear that Cross nor Brown ever applied a harmless error analysis. That there is no harmless error analysis in Bangert, except the fact that the error is only harmless if the defendant otherwise knew the correct information. I think that's the limited harmless error test that is present.
How
in
does
Bangert.
That square with Cross?
What?
How does that square with Cross?
I think it squares with Cross because Cross was always aware of the potential punishment he could be facing, the potential range of punishment. He was told he could get 40, so he necessarily knew he could get 30. So the legal maximum in Cross's case,
well,
I think that's...
That seems kind of counterintuitive for you to say on the one hand, the defendant must know...
The potential range of punishment he's facing. In Mr. Finley's case, he was never informed that the potential punishment was 4 years greater than the amount that the court could impose.
I'm sorry, say that again.
And Mr. Finley was not informed of the correct potential punishment in his case because he was informed that the
potential... Yes, but he got what was in the range of
after the
maximum.
After the fact of the sentence reduction, he got 23 and a half, which was 4 years... greater than was the amount that was told he'd get.
True.
And I think what Bangert protects is this idea that the harm that Bangert is concerned with is the harm of an unknowing plea. So Bangert doesn't ask us, would it have made a difference at the time had he known that it was 23 and a half years and not 19 and a half. It assumes that it would have made a difference because it makes it incumbent on the trial court, with the prosecutor's help, to tell the defendant all the 10 different subsections of Bangert, most recently cataloged in Brown.
Okay, thank
Counselor,
you.
If I agree with your argument, part of the plea here was the dismissal of suffocation, strangulation, some other matters that also arose in the same interaction. Those dismissed counts then would be brought back against the defendant as well, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So he goes back to the point he was at before he entered his plea,
okay,
plea agreement.
You.
Now, it sounds to me, by the way, are you done, Justice Gableman?
When I thanked her, I meant to indicate that, yes, we were done.
Okay, good. Sounds to me as if you're saying that this was a constitutional due process violation.
That's what I'm saying.
Because in Bangert, you're supposed to be told, and this is statutory too.
His
statute
yes.
says, supposed to be told, it doesn't exactly say you have to be told what the penalty is, but the range of penalties, there's some different language in there. Okay. So, from your standpoint, if I understand this, once Bangert is not satisfied, that is, once there is no trial court decision that this was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea, right?
Right.
Once that's decided, the end, you go back to plea. That's your
exactly.
position.
Exactly. A Bangert violation is the manifest injustice, and a Bangert violation always mandates plea withdrawal. That is the case law of this state.
And if you've got a strong argument here, if I understand both briefs, that the trial court said it was Kiv, but that the Court of Appeals said there isn't evidence to support that finding.
Yes.
So it's not Kiv.
Yes.
And the whole Court of Appeals is based on that it is not Kiv, therefore it doesn't fall under Taylor.
Correct.
Well, what's the matter with the argument that we, in effect, took in Cross? I know in Cross it's the opposite kind of error. close enough for government work?
Cross and then both Taylor reiterated that when a defendant is misinformed, when the penalty is understated at the time of the plea hearing, a defendant's due process rights are at greater risk. And I think that acknowledges that a defendant who pleads without knowing the worst possible penalty he could face upon conviction doesn't plead with the knowledge, intelligence, and voluntariness required by the Constitution.
So it's your position that both in Cross and Taylor, the defendant knowing and intelligent and voluntary understood what the real statute was, that is, what the maximum penalty was?
What the potential range of punishment, I think that's the language that the statute uses,
right. Mm-hmm.
Because there was the affirmative finding in Taylor that the defendant knew that it was 8 years and not six. And then in Cross, he knew the potential punishment of 30 when it was 40.
May I ask, if we write an opinion that closely tracks Mr. Ballesteri's brief. Do you see any parade of horribles coming from that? Any slippery slope?
Yes. I think...
What is it?
I'll try to...
Example, you're going to slip.
Describe. But, I think from the start, I think the state's proposed test is unclear. I'm not sure if the state is asking to remove the potential penalties, like the knowledge of potential penalties from Bangert and saying, all right, this isn't a Bangert, this is just, we're just going to do a manifest injustice test. But if that's the case, then is some of 97108 under Bangert and is the rest of it not under Bangert? Like where does the burden shifting apply and where doesn't it apply? And I also think who gets to decide between plea withdrawal or sentence reduction? Is there a chance that the defendant could ask for sentence reduction, say the misinformation is 10 years and not 4 years, and the state can mandate plea withdrawal? I don't think the state really has an answer for that, or the state's proposed test doesn't really seem to clearly state whether or not it's up to the defendant if he can choose. I think it's advocating that the defendant can't choose. I do think this will increase post-conviction litigation. One respect is because I think a logical outgrowth of this kind of thinking is what do we do with a Hampton violation? If the court doesn't inform the defendant that it's not bound by the plea agreement, can the remedy instead of plea withdrawal just be, all right, we'll give you what we said was in the plea agreement, even though that's contrary to case law. A defendant isn't entitled to what the plea agreement was. A defendant is only entitled to know that the court doesn't have to follow the plea agreement. And I also think part of my job when there's a Bangert violation is I ask the defendant if he knew the information he did not correctly receive. If he says yes, that's it. You know, that if he knew the information, that's not a Bangert violation anymore. And then if he says no, the next part of my job is I ask him if we talk about the risks of withdrawing his plea. And a lot of the time, a defendant doesn't want to withdraw his plea because it involves the risk of the plea agreement going away, the charges that were withdrawn or dismissed get put back. So I think if there's this other remedy, a more favorable remedy of sentence reduction, I do think this will increase post-conviction litigation because that would be more favorable to a defendant. Plea withdrawal is, because plea withdrawal is the only option in Bangert, it's a clear rule that is easily implemented, I can easily have a conversation with my client on whether he wants to do that or not do that. And I think the other question is where does this end? Maybe not just a Hampton violation, but can a sentence reduction, you know, fix a different Bangert violation? I think we're interjecting all this uncertainty into a rule that is clear. A Bangert violation is a manifest injustice and equals plea withdrawal.
Well, maybe we have to re-examine Bangert and not take the position that all the bases required by the statute, of which you have to tell the defendant, You don't have to tell them everything that's said there. Close enough is good enough. And then what you have here is he goes back to the beginning. And how many years have passed since the offense here?
2011, so about 5 years.
Not so bad, but it could be much more than that.
If it could be.
And witnesses are gone, victim might be gone, and then the state has to reconstruct the evidence, and chances are they can't or don't want to, because the person's been in prison a long time already. So then you have another plea agreement, rather than go to trial, which on the actual stated offense. What's the matter with that?
What's the matter with changing Maynard?
What we're doing is chipping away at it anyway. Don't you think that's what these cases say?
I think if we do what the state wants you to do, I think that is chipping away at Bangert and making sort of the protections that are embodied in Bangert no longer protections. And I do think that this court has adopted the Bangert test. Other jurisdictions like the state cited have a harmless error test. Both of these tests are still protections for a defendant to make sure he's entering into a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea. Bangert, I think, works, and it has worked, and the easiest way to forestall a Bangert attack or a Bangert motion is to do it right the first time, and that this court has repeatedly said that.
You said that a Bangert violation is manifest injustice, and the remedy is plea withdrawal. Is it that simple?
It is that simple. I believe it's that simple. But I think the question...
So as soon as anyone proves that there is an incorrect penalty given by the judge, plea withdrawal is the only remedy. That's not what Cross or Taylor say. That's
I think
the link.
Okay, so I think it's not just the misstatement of the penalty. It's the misstatement of the penalty, and then the defendant didn't know. The state doesn't prove that the defendant didn't know.
So
that's the actual Bangert violation.
Okay. So walk me through the test that we're applying. Is it the defendant's burden to show manifest injustice because this is post-sentencing, or is it something else?
So post-sentencing, the test for plea withdrawal is a manifest injustice. This court has said, though, when there's a defect in the plea colloquy and the defendant asserts that he did not understand the information he did not correctly receive, there's a burden shifting that happens. And the burden shifts to the state, then, to prove that the defendant otherwise knew the correct information. If that's not met, like it was not met in this case, that equals plea withdrawal. I think...
But the court found it was met. See, that's the rub, and that's why the bench is having a little bit of a issue with the state's concession.
The trial court found that the defendant did know the correct maximum penalty, and the state has conceded and said that Mr. Finley didn't know the correct maximum penalty.
Perhaps if you could elucidate between the direct testimony of the sole witness, the attorney, and the testimony on cross-examination where he clarified his direct testimony, that might be of benefit.
I can do that. Attorney Ferris was the defense counsel in this case. He testified that his usual practice is to review the maximum penalties with his clients prior to a plea hearing. His usual practice was also to review it line by line. And so it's undisputed that 19 and a half years is on the plea questionnaire. Attorney Ferris's testimony did not touch on, though, and it did not address his perception of whether Mr. Finley, in fact, understood the applicable penalties. It just dealt with what did he do to help inform Mr. Finley of the maximum penalties. So he testified to the best of his knowledge that Mr. Finley was aware of the maximum penalties, but he didn't really offer any testimony to explain or bolster that belief. And then on cross, post-conviction counsel at the time asked, isn't it your usual practice to go through line by line? So isn't it likely that you read 19 and a half years to him when you were reading the likely maximum penalties? And he said yes.
Would you be here if he initially received 19 and a half instead of 23 and a half?
I think we would. If it's the defendant's decision whether or not to withdraw his plea. So if he wanted to withdraw his plea, I think we would still be here.
Do we have to reverse Taylor and Cross then?
I don't think we have to reverse Taylor and Cross. I think the important takeaway from both Taylor and Cross is that both defendants were aware of the potential range of punishment they were receiving upon pleading guilty.
But if, for example, he was aware of 19 and a half and he got 19 and a half.
So, right. What Banger acknowledges is that the Banger test.
I know what you're saying, but that's back to my question. Is it as simple as a Banger violation is manifest injustice and the remedy must be plea withdrawal? Because that doesn't seem to gel with Taylor and Cross. And I think you're asking if those be reversed, maybe, if it's something as black and white as what you're asking for.
I don't think so, because I think the distinction of Taylor and Cross is that those defendants were aware of the potential range of punishments they could be facing upon pleading guilty. That cannot be true in Mr. Finley's case. He was told it was 19 and a half when the law says it's 23 and a half. And the Banger test doesn't have us consider whether it would have made a difference had Mr. Finley known that it was 23 and a half. It just assumes that it would have made a difference by making it incumbent on the circuit court with the prosecutor's help to show that the defendant was aware of all the 10 different subsections stated in Brown. And I think if we look at it in a common sense way, sort of what Justice Gableman was saying, like the potential range of punishment you're facing is one consideration that you have when you're deciding whether or not to enter into a plea or go to trial. Other considerations might be, how could the state prove this offense at trial? What would my defense be at trial? But I think the real question is, how can a person intelligently weigh the risks involved in entering a guilty plea if you're misinformed of part of the considerations that this court has stated you need to know in order to enter into a valid and intelligent plea?
Counselor, most of the argument has been on the incorrect adding of the penalties. But the penalties that were stated for each of the parts of the sentence were accurate, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Do you know of any other case where the individual sentences that are required as a maximum were correctly stated, but the error really is an addition error?
I think a good corollary maybe is State v. Sutton, which is a Court of Appeals case. In that decision, the defendant was saying he wasn't aware of the initial confinement time. And what the court held is you just have to be informed of the maximum term of imprisonment. And that's basically what Mr. Finley was misinformed of in this case.
Were there multiple parts of the sentence? Like here it was an enhancement because of a weapon and a repeater and...
I believe in State v. Sutton, there were two charges. So the two charges added to, there was two different initial confinement times.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Cross, wasn't that the one where he gave, the judge gave the amount of the basic crime charge, but forgot to add in the 2 years from the enhancement?
That was Taylor.
Pardon? That was Taylor. And so that's like this and that. There was an addition error because he just forgot that there was this enhancement. It was a penalty enhancement, wasn't it?
That's correct, yes.
And Taylor. So he just forgot to add that, and he just looked at the offense and not the complaint had a penalty enhancer, and he didn't look at that. I mean, that's how I remember the case, and that's how I reread it.
And I think the Court of Appeals, Judge Cruz's decision in the Court of Appeals, has a very detailed and intelligent analysis of why this case isn't amenable to the sort of resolution that was applied in Taylor. And it's because in Mr. Finley's case, there was the underlying felony offense, the repeater enhancer, and the dangerous weapon enhancer. You can't take off any of those enhancement provisions and make it the 19 and a half years Mr. Finley was informed he could receive. So whether there's a question of whether the enhancement provision was knowingly entered and the difference between the underlying penalty and the enhancement provision, I don't think that question can be easily answered here because 19 and a half isn't, we can't get that addition in any way.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Balistrieri. How would you write this opinion? Now, on page 16, Mr. Balistrieri referred me to the brief. The brief says that where the defendant is misinformed of the correct maximum penalty, which is either too high or too low, it doesn't change. In the ordinary case, reduction of the sentence is the less drastic and therefore preferred remedy. But in an exceptional case, which is undefined in the brief, although he gave the maximum sentence example here, mandatory maximum, in an exceptional case, there may be a manifest injustice that requires withdrawal of the plea. That's how we would like this opinion drafted. Now, you're supporting the Court of Appeals opinion here?
I'm supporting the Court of Appeals opinion, and I think both Cross and Taylor recognize that when a defendant is misinformed of the maximum penalty, it's when it's understated at the plea hearing, a defendant's due process rights are at greater risk, and a Bangert violation may be established. And here, I think the court could hold that you could enforce and revitalize Bangert and hold that when the maximum penalty is understated at the plea hearing, when the defendant is told that it's less than that allowed by law, and the state fails to show that the defendant otherwise knew the correct maximum penalty, that this is a Bangert violation, and a Bangert violation mandates plea withdrawal.
Now, had state proved in an acceptable way that there was a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea, then you would, this was asked of you, but I would assume that the answer is that it would come under Taylor or Clark, Cross. And you reduce the sentence to what was actually, I don't mean promised, but at least asserted by the trial court. Is that right?
Well, if it's shown that the defendant knows the maximum penalty, then that's not a Bangert violation anymore. Because the Bangert requires that he doesn't know, and that there be an error in the colloquy. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
I think it's important, given the oral arguments that have been made by public defender in this case, to go back to the source. To go back to Bangert, let's see what Bangert has to say about plea withdrawal being the only available remedy. Bangert 131, with second 246, at page 611, says this. That's the wrong page. Page 283. Says this: when a defendant establishes a denial of a relevant constitutional right, not just a Bangert violation, a violation of a relevant constitutional right, withdrawal of the plea is a matter of right. The trial court reviewing the motion to withdraw has no discretion in such an instance. Then let's go back a ways. Let's go back to page 260 of Bangert, where Bangert quotes Section 971.08 of the Wisconsin statutes, which says that before a judge accepts a plea of guilty, it should address the defendant and determine that the defendant understands the potential punishment if convicted. That's a statutory requirement adopted in Bangert as a rule imposed by this court. But then let's go to the next page, page 261, footnote 3. A violation of section 971.08, though itself not constitutionally significant, may have constitutional ramifications. So what Bangert is saying, a little offhandedly, they don't address the issue head on, but what they're saying is a failure to tell the defendant the correct potential punishment is not itself constitutionally significant. And since only constitutional violations require plea withdrawal as the only remedy, what Bangert is suggesting is that failure to tell the defendant the correct maximum is not one of those violations where the only remedy is plea withdrawal.
Counsel?
It is not necessarily constitutional.
What about one of our more recent interpretations or applications of Bangert? That is the Brown decision. When I say more recent, I think it was 2006, but that was an application of Bangert when it said in paragraph 19, when a guilty plea is not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, a defendant is entitled to withdraw the plea as a matter of right because such a plea violates fundamental due process.
Then you go a little bit further. You go to Cross and you go to Taylor, which specifically say that failure to tell the defendant the correct maximum penalty is not necessarily a due process violation.
And then the issue is whether or not Taylor and Cross are all distinguishable, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the path that leads us here today from, well, going back to Repin, you know, where you adopted the manifest injustice standard, and through Bangert, and then through Brown and Cross and Taylor is not exactly as clear as it might be. I'm hoping today we get that clarification, and that's what I'm asking for.
Both Cross and Taylor, the defendant knew what the correct maximum was, right?
In fact, yeah. I don't think he did in Cross. In Taylor, he certainly did.
Okay.
Opposing counsel answered my question about the parade of horribles and slippery slope, and I think there ought to be some rebuttal.
My rebuttal was the very first thing I said when I came here for the oral argument today, that there's just one issue. It is a very narrow issue. It's a very specific issue, and that is whether in the circumstance that we face in this case, where the defendant was misadvised, the correct maximum penalty was given the correct maximum, which was then reduced, in that situation, is is sentence reduction an appropriate remedy? That's the only issue here. It doesn't go anywhere else, and I will cite your concurring opinion in Taylor, where you say that what the court has been doing is looking at these situations as individual situations, and that's all I'm asking you to do. Very specific remedy for a Bangert violation. We're not talking about whether there was a Bangert violation. There was. What's the remedy? That's the only issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very, very interesting arguments, and thank you for fine briefs. They were very helpful. We are going to take a brief recess now so that new students may may be able to join us, and we'll be back for our second case in just a little bit. So we are adjourned.